In 1 Peter 1, we read, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that can never perish, never spoil, never fade." A new birth into a new hope. How great is that? And how rare do we actually think that we've been given a new birth into a new hope when we walk around each day? I have two stories that have to do with me driving a vehicle. I was only supposed to tell one, and then last night happened. And so last evening, we were out and about with our family and getting ready to split up and do some different things. I needed to get home to help to continue to spend a few hours preparing for this because it had been one of those weeks. And so on our way home, all of a sudden, I see this like blinking light on my dashboard, and I pull over really quickly and get out of the car just enough time to hear psh, and I look and my tire is literally deflating because I drove over the sharpest rock in Delaware. So none of you have to worry about it because I found it. It has been laid to rest, never to hurt anyone again. Somehow, just a little stone stuck 2 inches through the inside of my tire, and that was the end of my normal afternoon. And so I spent until about 8 o'clock that night at Pep Boys because we are driving to the mountains today. And so we had to replace the whole tire and get it all set up before somebody closed and because I couldn't do it today. And I remember thinking, you know what? This would happen. Have you ever had one of those thoughts? You know what? This would happen. Something like this would happen. Now, here's a question. If I had been driving along and somebody flagged me over because they saw me and they came over to my car and said, "Hey, I know it's not your birthday, but I have this birthday cake and I just wanted to give it to you. Hope you have a great day." How many of us would have been like, you know what? Something like that would happen to me. We are such a cynical culture, right? That we live in this sense of incoming dread. This sense of the worst case scenario. This sense that, yeah, that would happen because that's the way it goes. It always goes the bad way. It always goes the way that we think is the worst case scenario. We always look at something and we just kind of live with this sense of, this kind of low level sense of kind of doubt, dread, concern, whatever about everything that we hear. We're skeptics, many of us, because of our experiences and stuff by nature. And cynicism is the defense mechanism to whenever we are hurt or whenever we are angry. Now we know that it's linked to disease and ultimately linked to death. People who are deeply cynical die younger than those who are not. The newest studies just came out a couple of years ago where they can judge the way that people look at the world and how that changes their long-term sense of health and well-being. But here's the thing, we don't have to be people who are defined by cynicism. We have been given something that we need so badly for so many reasons, and that is the actual physical resurrection of Jesus. I had a second story that I was going to tell because a week and a half, God kind of used it to stir something in me. I drive a bus, not much anymore, but I have my CDL because I used to help this school with a bus route when they were in crisis a couple years ago, just to help them with the afternoon route because I was able to work that into my schedule and it helped us show love to a spirit here. And so I keep my license up in case they need to call me, the company that Aspira subcontracts with, in case they need to call me for any number of reasons. I only drive a couple times a year these days. So 2 weeks ago, they asked me, because it was in the middle of the crazy spring, they asked me if I could come in and do a sports drop, a baseball team and a tennis team. So I picked up the bus here in the parking lot, and it was actually another school, so I went over and picked them up. And I'm driving this team down 95 from Newark up into Wilmington. I'm driving them up 95, I guess. And in the middle of that, the dashboard, it was a newer bus, starts going crazy. Beep, beep, like the same sound of when you open the alarm. You remember that when you rode buses as kids or the window? Some kids always fiddling with the window. But it's that like jarring, like whoa. And on the screen it says, coolant dangerously low, engine damage shortly. Add coolant. And that's not my job, people. I start the bus, I drive the bus, I stop the bus. This is what I do. I'm not the mechanic. And so So I'm a little bit trying to keep my cool, but writing down 95, thinking that, you know, and all of a sudden now I'm smelling like that coolant, that burning smell. I'm looking at the sensor and the transmission, 145, 160 degrees, 175 degrees. I'm thinking, should I pull over right now? Because that doesn't seem like necessarily a real safe thing, but neither does this. I'm really close. I'm like 6 minutes away. You know, I'm 190, 195, 204. And I'm like, this, I don't know how high these things go, but this can't be good. And so I'm having this battle in my mind, trying to really drive safely with about, you know, 30 athletes in my bus. And we finally park, thank goodness, at the school. And I turn the bus off, and I quickly call my guy who oversees, one of the owners of the company, who oversees this lot of buses. And I said, Davey, man, I don't know what's happening, but here's the thing that's beeping, and it looks like I'm really low. Can I walk somewhere to get coolant, or can you send somebody over before I start this thing back up? And he goes, oh, forgot to tell you. I got a call this morning about the same thing. The sensor's broken. I just filled it with coolant right before you left. You're good. I said, the sensor's broken. He said, yeah, the sensor's broken. So you're just going to have to deal with the loud beeping, but know that it's okay. So I was a little skeptical because it's beeping right in my face here. But I started up again. I realized that maybe I was reading into the smell just a little bit, you know, because maybe that's just kind of the way buses smell. It's been a while since I had been driving. So I start driving down the highway, and I start thinking about Davey and how much he has, how much stake he has in the decision. Because if I mess up the engine, that's a lot of money, right? And that's a lot of work, and that's a lot of time, and that's a big deal if you blow a transmission. So I start thinking, I should probably trust his words. And so I begin to move into a different state of mind, and as I do, the beeping doesn't stop. But all of a sudden, I am able to focus on what I am supposed to be doing, instead of being completely consumed with the worst case scenario. And afterwards, I got done, and all I could keep thinking about was, the sensor's broken. The sensor's broken. And God had been stirring me to kind of move, I think, to talk about the nature of cynicism in response to the resurrection. And all I could think of was, what if the deal is that as we look around the world, what if our sensors are broken? I was able to do what I was meant to do when I realized that the loudest sound was not the correct one. You feel me? The loudest sound that I was hearing was not the correct one. And often the loudest sound is that beeping, is that doomsday, is that everything is just so messed up beyond any hope. I am, you are, everything is, the church is, whatever it might be. Our sensors sometimes tell us a story, but it's not always the real story or the whole story. And those sensors tell us a story about ourselves and about the world. But if we don't identify the deepest truth underneath our stories, we'll never be able to do what we were created to do, because we will be overcome with failure, fear, and judgment. And that's when we get cynical. I think that there's kind of four ways that this stuff enters into our lives. The first one, where'd you all go? The first one is our failure. Have you noticed that we can really become cynical when we start to fall into patterns of failure, where we struggle with something, some character trait that we can't quite shake off, some nagging sin or a way that we respond to people, or something that we look at and we say, God, I've been trying, but I just keep failing. And we eventually start to say, is there any hope for me? Because I'm just not living up to who I want to be. What sense does the resurrection make of this? There's this story in John about the disciple Peter. And if you know much about the story, you know that, and on Friday night, we had this story read aloud, and I just kept, the Peter story is so significant to me, but I kept hearing when we read it three or four times throughout the sacred space time on Good Friday. And what we hear is when Jesus tells Peter, hey, you're going to deny me three times, and Peter says, absolutely not, no way, never. And then when that happens, and when the rooster crows, and Peter is reminded that he denies Jesus, it says that Jesus glances at him at that moment as the rooster crows. And I just thought about what was in those eyes. We don't know. I can take a guess, but was it anger? Was it disappointment? Was it understanding? Was it love? So a few days later, after the death of Jesus, there has been word that Jesus is resurrected, but Peter is not a part of the disciples at this point. In fact, in Mark 16, when Jesus rises and reveals himself to Mary and says, go and tell the disciples and Peter. Catch that? Go and tell the disciples and Peter, because he's not one of them anymore. He's, whether he did it on his own or whether he was excommunicated by the rest of the group, he was their leader and he was expelled from the group. I'm guessing that Peter self-selected out. But so Peter's on the outside of this group. He's gone back to fishing. Jesus is on the shore. He reappears. He calls them. There's this miraculous moment. And Peter comes and jumps into the water because he realizes that it's Jesus. I'm just setting up the backstory. You can read it yourself. He gets to the shore. He sees Jesus. He sits down with Jesus. And eventually he has a conversation with Jesus. And when he's doing that, he's having it at a fire. Interestingly, where he denied Jesus was at a fire. It's the only two times fire is talked about in the book of John. So we get the smell and the sense that we are back in that same place. And when we get there, Jesus has a conversation one-on-one with Peter. And in that conversation, what happens is that Jesus asks three times to Peter, Peter, do you love me? And each time, Peter says, yes, I love you. It happens over and over again. Do you love me more than these? Don't worry about these. There's a lot of, we're not going to get into that. It might be the fish. It might be this way of life. I do not believe he's trying to set himself up and say, do you love me more than the rest of the disciples? But anyways, he says, do you love me? And Peter says, yes. And then he asks it again, and Peter says yes. And then he asks it again, and Peter's wounded the third time. And what's often thought about is that the reason that he's wounded on the third time is that he asks him three times, just like Peter denied him three times. Now, that's absolutely true. But there's something that we often miss here because we're not looking at this at the original language. There's three different words for love in the scriptures. Okay, the first one is eros. That's the type of love that is found in the bedroom. Okay, then we have philios or phileo or philos, and that is where we get Philadelphia. It's brotherly love. It's a deep friendship, a deep love that you might have for a family member. But then you have also agape or agapao, and that word is a self-giving, self-sacrificial, laying down one's life kind of a love. And that's the love that we get when we talk about God each time. That's the word that's used in the New Testament. So here's what happens. The first time Jesus looks at Peter, and he says, Peter, agapao, do you love me with a self-giving, all-emptying, lay-down-your-life kind of love? And Peter looks back at him, and when he says, you know that I love you, he doesn't use the same word for love. He uses phileo. He says, Jesus, you know I'm your friend, and I care about you deeply. But see, Peter knows because of what he's done, he knows that he doesn't have the capacity to say, yes, I love you with the self-giving, never-ending, lay down my life kind of love. So he can't get there. And so the next thing Jesus does is he says again to Peter, do you love me? Agapao. He uses the same word. And Peter looks at him and he gives the same response. And he says, Lord, you know, phileo, I love you like a brother. I care deeply for you. But not agapao, not the self-sacrifice. Then Jesus asks a third time. But when Jesus asks a third time, here's what happens. Jesus uses the different word. Jesus changes the tense. And Jesus says, Peter, do you phileo? Do you love me like a friend? Will you be my friend, Peter? And Peter is wounded, and he's not wounded because he's offended by Jesus. He is overcome with emotion because Jesus is willing to come and meet him where he's at, even though he can't meet Jesus where Jesus is at. And so Peter is overwhelmed with emotion, and he says, yes, Lord, phileo, I love you deeply, but I can't get there. It reminds me of the times when my daughter was 5 years old, and we would be playing on a creek bank, and I would be down in the water, and she'd be up there, and she'd want to come down, and she looked, and it was too far to jump. And so I said, hold on, honey, I'm coming up. And so I would come up, scramble up, I would grab her, and then together we would jump down. I'll meet you where you are at. You don't have to come and meet me where I'm at. That's the story that Jesus says to the person who experiences one of the deepest failures that we have in all of recorded history in the Bible. Peter fails so completely, and Jesus says, listen, you are so full of the idea that you are a failure, you are a failure, you are a failure. And instead, here's what I'm going to say. I will come and meet you where you are, and we will start there. I will come, and I will be your friend. And if that's all you can do right now, that's all we can do. And I will extend such grace that I will come there. Sorry, I didn't show the slide so that you can join me in this. After this, Jesus has been saying, feed my sheep. Go and care for my people. He is commissioning Peter one more time to do that. And then he says, very truly, I told you when you were younger and you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you're old, you'll stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Peter would eventually give his life. So Jesus looks at him and he says, hey, we're doing this brotherly love thing right now, Peter, but guess what? One day, you'll get there. One day, you will have such agape love that it will spread from you and you will lay down your own life. I believe in you. You are not a failure. I will walk with you now and I will walk with you then. And the final thing he says to him is, lecharai, come and follow me. The exact same phrase he said at the beginning of Peter's journey. I will start again with you. I will use you. Your time is not done. When we understand the depths of God's love and grace and forgiveness, we start to see things differently than in terms of our own failure. We have to be able to see the grace of God in the resurrected Jesus who did not come back and say, hey, guess what? I'm alive and I am ticked. What he does is he comes and he raises and he says, yes, you failed me, Peter. But there is enough love because I absorbed your sin. I've dealt with it. And I come back not to retaliate on the world, but to invite the world into the same love that I experienced with the Father. Oh, it's so beautiful. Okay, so what else do we do? We also, so our failure is kind of when we look down into ourselves. Here's one. Others' failure. This makes us really cynical, right? This makes us really cynical when we look around and we see the people that have disappointed us in our lives. We look around and we see people who screwed up and it hurt us, it wounded us, it let us down. People that we loved, people that we thought were better than that, and we eventually just start to say, you know what? Nobody can be trusted. Nobody can be trusted. This is a pretty big deal. There's a shift that has come in our culture that's really significant. A theologian recently said this. He said, what we've done, we look at the world so critically and we look at others so critically that we take Descartes' famous comment of existence. I think, therefore I am. Okay, and we have a modern version of it, and that modern version is, I think, you're dumb. And this is our operating motif. Our entire outlook on life is based on being critical of the people around us. I think, therefore I am, has become, I think, you're dumb. And it's a problem. It's a problem because it changes how we can relate to the world. And Peter comes back into the story here because as a beautiful example, do you realize that Peter didn't just let Jesus down? Peter let all of the disciples down. And the fact that Jesus forgave Peter did not necessarily equate that the rest of the disciples would. Peter disappointed the rest of the disciples. Now they screwed up too, but Peter was the most vocal about it in his denial. Of course, we have the example of Judas, which we're not going to get into, which, by the way, we have no reason to believe that Judas would not have been forgiven had he not killed himself. But what we get is we get this image of somehow in the early church, they are back behind Peter, letting him lead them. Somehow, they got a grasp of the fact that God's forgiveness is so deep for each of them and for Peter that they could maybe express the same type of forgiveness to look beyond the mistakes that someone has made and see the worth and the value. This is a massive, massive challenge, and the only way that we can get beyond becoming cynical because of other people's failures is if we truly grasp the depths of forgiveness, not just for us now, but for all. if we grasp the fact that Jesus looks at other people and he sees beyond the things that we see, the things that determine who we are, the things that define, that we say define you. And we say, actually, you know what defines you is you're worth dying for. You are a deeply loved, infinitely valuable person who is created in the image of God, every single person. And when we do that, we begin to be able to not live based on that cynical outlook at people. Here's the other thing. You know how many times it takes when someone insults you and then compliments you? Have you heard of this? Like the impact of one insult is like the impact of 10 compliments? Like it's really, really unbounded. We do the same thing when we look at people and see the flaws and we see the people that have let us down. Here's what we need to learn to do. We need to also seek out the people that do the opposite, the faithful ones, the ones who inspire us. Fred Rogers had this famous quote that he said that in the midst of tragedy, his mother would look at him and she would say, "Always look for the helpers." When you see great evil and great wickedness and great tragedy, look around and focus on the helpers because there's always helpers. And let that restore your faith that there's something good out there. Don't give up on that. Hold on to that. Look for it. You will find them. We have to look, just like we look at the Peters of the world, we have to look at the other ones, the ones who give us an example in faithfulness. See, the story that is rarely told, and I don't know why, but it is so rarely told, is the story of the women in the Passion story. See, we're told that the disciples deserted Jesus. Not all of them. The women stayed. The women were there at the base of the cross. The women never left. And they are an example for us to inspire us to follow. The women were the ones who went to the tomb because even after the death of Jesus, there was something that pulled in them. They had to continue to be near him. So the whole spices story, sure, it's worth it. All right, somebody flag me if it takes more than 45 seconds. So the way that you would prepare a body for burial was that you would wrap the body up and put spices in, and then you would put them in the tomb. And within a short period of time, sorry, it's a little gory, the body would break down, the spices would help with the stench, and then you would go back in a few months later and you would gather up the bones, much like we would with an urn for someone who's been cremated, that sort of a thing. And you would keep those bones in what's called an ossuary or a bone box, and you would travel that, you would keep that with you for your loved ones. Because Jesus was crucified right at the end of sundown on Friday, Sabbath was coming. And so that's why it's important that Jesus died quickly. Once Jesus died, they wanted to make sure he was dead so that they could get his body down and care for him. Otherwise, he would have hung there all the way until Sunday because you couldn't work on Saturday. So the women have been waiting. They can't work on Saturday, but as soon as Sunday morning happens, as soon as Sabbath is over, they're there with the spices, hoping to get back into the tomb, hoping to continue to care for Jesus, realizing on the way, by the way, that they don't have any idea how they're going to get inside. It says they began talking with themselves about how they could get the stone moved or who could move it. And of course they get there and the stone is rolled away. And because they continue to pursue Jesus, because they continue to faithfully look after, they're given the gift of being the ones who get to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus. Woo! Let them inspire you. We need more women that inspire us. There's plenty out there. We just got to fix our eyes on them at the right times. Right, ladies? Okay, so. All right, so. We've got our others' failure. How about this one? Oh boy, this one's going to touch some nerves. All right. Others' failure is when we look and we see people and the things they've done wrong. Okay, then how cynical do we become when we feel like God fails us? Maybe the most cynical I've seen anyone is a part of and in response to what's understood as God's failure. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about here, right? A prayer that you had faith in, that you asked for, that you were sure was God's will. And by the way, may very well have been God's will. God's will is that none should perish. God's will is that the kingdom would be present on earth as it is in heaven. It's just not fully accomplished yet. In the here and now, but you see something and it doesn't work out the way you want, and you're so deeply wounded, and you have nothing left, and your faith begins to become cynical. I've seen it happen with so many people that I love. There's a story in Luke about some disciples, even after the word had gotten out about how Jesus had maybe risen, all that was really out there was that Jesus wasn't around anymore. And so what ended up happening is that they've heard this story and they're walking on a road to Emmaus. It's two of them. And Jesus appears to them, but they can't see that it's Jesus because he looks different. So somehow Jesus joins them, but they don't realize it's him. And Jesus says, hey, what are you all talking about? And they say, well, you know, who isn't talking about this? And he says, no, I don't. And he said, they say, what, you've been living under a rock? Here's the story. Jesus, this guy came and we thought he was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. What's more, then they say, we don't know what to make of all of this because some people went to the tomb and they say he's risen, but we just have no idea. But here's the bottom line. We had hoped that he was the one to redeem. That word redeem is the same word as liberate. We hoped that Jesus was going to liberate us. Don't you remember Palm Sunday last week? We waved palm branches and we said, yes, it's time. The kingdom will one day come and Jesus will set us free from our oppressors. And Romans are our oppressors right now, so that's what's going to happen. And it didn't. Here's the interesting thing, though. They say, we had hoped that God was going to do something, and it just didn't happen. So now we're just walking, trying to figure out what our next purpose is. And Jesus joins them. As he joins them, he begins to talk with them about the scriptures and how they point to him and talk about all of this happening and the prophets and how it's all eventually working together to talk about how Jesus was the Messiah and this was the path that he would have to take because of the self-giving, self-sacrificial, sin-absorbing love of God. And so when this happens, eventually they begin, their minds start churning, but it isn't until they get to their town, Jesus acts like he's going to go on. They say, no, please hang out with us. And he says, fine, because he loves a good meal. And so they sit down to dinner, and when Jesus breaks the bread, all of a sudden, their eyes are opened. When Jesus breaks bread, their eyes are opened. And then Jesus disappears from them. But here's the thing. They then say, my gosh, weren't our hearts burning inside us when he told us all these things about the scriptures, when he opened our eyes? And they quickly go back and they tell the disciples. But here's what we need to know. Why are they so excited? Because Jesus still didn't redeem Israel, right? So when we read that the disciples here, their eyes were opened, okay, this is what Jesus said. You can read it in Luke 24 yourself. When he was at the table, he broke bread, gave thanks, and then disappeared, right? Their eyes are open and they recognize him. Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? But it says their eyes were open. And here's the thing. If their eyes were open, see, they didn't just recognize Jesus. They recognized Jesus. They finally got who Jesus was because they were excited to go back and proclaim what's been going on. And what they were proclaiming wasn't, hey, let's get the army together. It's on. What it was, oh my goodness, the redemption of Israel that has been talked about, this is so much bigger than any of us had ever imagined. They started to understand because Jesus opened their mind to the scriptures. They began to see the scriptures through the lens of Jesus, and that changed everything. When they began to see the scriptures through the eyes of Jesus and through the lens of Jesus, they realized that the salvation that was being talked of was one that would be accessible to everybody, that hope and grace and forgiveness was accessible now beyond the sacrificial system, beyond the Jewish temple system, to everyone. And this changes the world. It changes everything. It's hard to have faith. But when we realize that maybe God's failure, maybe is God needing to open our eyes fresh to the way that God works, to both the mystery and the love and the ongoing redemption of all things, we're told that life is hard. We're told that we're not going to be free from suffering. We're told that there is brokenness that even breaks God's heart still in the world. But we're also told, if you believe the resurrection, if you actually believe somebody rose from the dead, all cynicism is grounded in death ultimately, all of it. So things change so beautifully and so rapidly if we truly believe that the power of death has been broken. Then we can trust that even in the midst of feeling like God is letting us down, that maybe as we fix our eyes on Jesus, our hearts and our eyes get open to a new and more robust way of understanding our faith. So that's when we look all over the place. Or no, sorry, that's when we look up. I'm not very good with my arrows today. So finally then, the last thing is when we look around at our world, when we look around at the church, and when we say, oh, look at how bad everything is, that's when we look backwards. And we look back and we say, look at all of the Look at all the lack of integrity. Look at how the church murdered people during the Crusades to talk about how Jesus, the Prince of Peace, was the one to save you. You know, like, look at what we've done. Look at how people abuse power. Look at all the suffering in our world, and we get so heavy, and we just begin to say, I've seen it before. I know how it ends. Boom. There's a little glimpse at the beginning of John in John 1 when Jesus calls Philip, and Philip goes over to his buddy Nathaniel, and he says, hey, I think I found the one, the Messiah. And Nathaniel's response, oh, he's Jesus from Nazareth. And Nathaniel's response is, Nazareth? What good can come from there? Have you ever like had that viewpoint of life? I know that story. I know those people. I know that area. I know, oh, what good could come out of that? I've seen this thing unfold before. That's just the way they are. Let me tell you, Nazareth ain't putting out anything impressive lately. And we just stay and we look at the church and we say the church is just a bunch of hypocrites. And we look at the world and we say the world is just drunk on power. And we say there's no hope. Let me tell you, friends, we have to change our viewpoint. Because the response to Nathaniel is so beautiful. Philip looks at him, he says, he doesn't say, you're wrong. He says, come and see. Come and see. What a great response to a cynic. Like us. Let's not think of the cynic as them. What a great response to us. Every time we get cynical, come and see. Come and see if anything good can come out of Nazareth. Come engage. Come and meet Jesus. And all of a sudden, come and see becomes go and tell. And go and tell, after a bit more, becomes we are the church. And Nathaniel is a part of building God's kingdom. All of a sudden, he becomes the church. Before, he was the cynic. What good can come out of Nazareth? All of a sudden, we'll come and see. And then go and tell, Nathaniel. Join the disciples. And then all of a sudden, the early church begins. And it's founded on cynics like Nathaniel. See, the importance of the come and see and go and tell is that we have to learn that in our own cynicism, instead of looking at the church and saying the church is just screwed up, we are the church, so we get to be a part of redefining what the beautiful church looks like. We get to be a part of building a church that reflects Jesus. We get to be a part of building an earth that is just and beautiful and reflects the character and the heart of God and value for all people. We get to be a part of this. Be the change that you want to see in the world. Be the church that you want to see in the world. I love that quote from Gandhi. It's an important one. It's a universal quote, and it matches Jesus. Come and follow me. Don't just believe. If we trust Jesus, we're going to do the things he did. So it just requires this shift in the way that we look at things. The broken sensors are going to keep beeping, okay? We have got to learn to see the bigger story beyond it because we've been told something better. I want you to listen to a song that has continued to inspire me over the years by a small independent group called Lost and Found. It goes through the journey of looking out with certain lenses at the world. And it's just a couple minutes. And if it's helpful to close your eyes, go for it. In just a second, I'm going to invite Lacey up, and we're going to chat for just a couple of minutes. But I just want you to hear the perspective of the lens that we take and how it affects how we see the world, okay? So just take a few moments and just be still and enter into this song.
Must be that the world's gone blind. Must be that the world's gone blind. I can't believe that we could see some things and just go on with our lives. Well, it must be that the world is blind. Must be that the world's gone dumb. Must be that the world's gone dumb. I can't believe that we could be so silent when we see what we might become. Well, it must be that the world is dumb. Must be that the world's gone lame. must be that the world's gone lame. I can't believe the wicked sit so still while the furious fan the flame. Well, it must be that the world is lame. Must be that the world's been saved. Must be that the world's been saved. The blind will see and the dumb will talk. The chains will fall and the lame will walk. And the dead will rise from the grave. Well, it must be that the world is saved. Must be that the world is saved.
Do you see that shift? Anger, frustration, despair. See, the problem isn't that our cynicism is never rooted in truth. The problem is that our cynicism stays and is never redeemed. There's this musical interlude in the middle. And I imagine Jesus on the cross in the midst of that, absorbing the realities of the world is blank, our cynicism, taking them down to the grave and leaving them there and rising. And saying that it's not just about the meme, you know, you've seen this before, right? It's not just about us ignoring reality. It's not to look at the world through the lens of the resurrection is not to say that we don't acknowledge real brokenness and ignore it. It's to say that we understand that the power of hope, because death has been defeated and because we have been invited into life with Jesus, that power of hope is stronger than the powers of death and darkness and sin and brokenness and injustice in the world. That's the power in this. It's not ignoring it. It's saying that God redeems all things. God is so beautiful and full that when we are invited into life with Jesus, we can look at things through a completely different lens and we say, wow, God is continuing to unfold beauty. Come on up, Lacey. One of the things that happens when we truly understand that the resurrection is not a happy ending to God's story, but it's rather a new beginning to a new creation. When we do that, we get a restored innocence in a certain way. There's a French philosopher named Paul Ricoeur, and he talks about the journey of faith and belief and how it starts with what he calls first naivety. And first naivety is that you just have things that you assume, maybe about the way the world works or about God, and you just have it, and it's fine, and you don't have any challenges with it. But eventually you move into confusion when something's tested. An assumption about the world or about people, an assumption about God, something that you've been told it doesn't work out, and you go into a state of confusion. He says that most people, if they stay there, they just become cynics. But if you continue to lean into what's true and real, eventually you move into a second step of faith. And that second step of faith is actually called a second naivety. That's how he defines it. And the second naivety means that it's not a blind faith anymore, but it's a restored sense of hope that's not defined by your cynicism. And it's marked by even a bit of a new sense of innocence. So I invite Lacey up because Lacey's been in an ongoing journey for a few years with us and in her own life and faith that's encountered Jesus. And you had been following Jesus for much of your life, but there's been certain renewals and hope that have emerged recently. So my question for you is, what's one way that Jesus has brought renewed innocence and hope into your journey? And you are supposed to have this, sorry.
Yeah, as Keith said, I've definitely walked through times of confusion, frustration, anger, all of those. When I first started at LifePath, I was very much in the God's failure, looking at that and mistrusting others and the world because of it and myself. So those all sound spot on. But the thing that changed was experiencing Jesus's constancy and his character. Him meeting me just like he met Peter, not letting me stay in that place, and his character. I couldn't, as much as I wanted to walk away from him and deny him, I couldn't ignore the fact that this beautiful universe was made by someone. And if that's the case, then it's my responsibility to understand why and why I'm a part of it. And putting those pieces back together, not based on all the rote knowledge that had been spoken from pulpits for all the years of my life, but it was something that I was truly understanding, which is kind of hard to explain. But I think Peter gets it. I know a lot of you get it, and it is sort of that magical new experience of Jesus.
I think we have many conversions over the course of our life that Jesus brings us to himself in a new way. There's this one story where Jesus heals a blind person, and he touches him, and they look around, they say, well, I see people, but they look like trees. And did Jesus what's a good way to say that? Not a good first round, you know? I touched you on the wrong spot on the face there to heal you. Is that what was going on? Because he touches him again, and then he can see clearly. And the disciples are having a hard time understanding the character of God. And so it's right in the midst of their struggle where they need to be reminded that sometimes Jesus needs to touch us again and again and again to renew our vision and clarify our sight and keep refining us and keep renewing our hearts. And that's the beauty of faith. We continue to have God do that. So with that, the second question, then last question is, what specifically about the resurrection helps or inspires you to move, to continue that journey from cynicism toward hope?
Yeah. I'm always looking for patterns in our world, the things that God set into creation that speak to who he is and what he's doing. And especially springtime, those first shoots of new buds and little plants coming in their bright color after such a dark, dreary time of winter, coldness, snow, whatever the case may be, bleakness. When I see that, it's such a strong reminder that of the resurrection, the way that Jesus brought hope back when everyone had lost it, all their expectations had been crushed, and then the hope that he offers us, that he can change broken things. And
maybe that's the only way, right? Until
yeah.
they're broken, until disappointments and
right
ideas
to experience that, and you go through these processes and you go through seasons. It doesn't mean I might not end up there again in another winter stage, but I have the faithful reminders of God's presence in my life, and if that is the work that he's doing in me, then he's doing that in the church. He's doing that in others, and so it helps enlarge the grace that I have for people, for other churches, for those who have wronged. They are also works in progress that he's redeeming.
Yeah, and that's the beauty is not just that, sometimes we will be wounded and hurt. It's choosing to continue to look at those people with that idea, that mindset, that attitude of, oh, I'm just so angry that I can't let that go, versus seeing the brokenness and God's redemptive hope, and even being able to see the gray areas where there's good. You know, I might disagree with this or that, or I may struggle with that, but there's certainly going to be good there too, and I don't want to deny those things. And that's the movement that we can have when we believe that the resurrection is God working to redeem all things in all of us. Thanks, Lacey. Appreciate your sharing. I can take that. The beauty of moving from cynicism to hope is founded in the fact that nothing can ever shake the power of love. We're told that God is the essence of love in the scriptures. It's one of the names for God. It's who God is. When we love in the truest way, we are seeing God, John writes. There's a a passage that I want us to be just encouraged by as we prepare to go out for the rest of the day. It's in the book of 1 Corinthians, and it's known as the love chapter. And it's used at weddings all the time. Every time I do a wedding, they want to use this. But it begins with things about love is patient and kind, and it's not envious, and it's not self-seeking, and it doesn't boast, and it keeps no record of wrongs, and all of these beautiful things, which you could also, by the way, put Jesus in place of love each of those times, and it remains accurate. But what I find is really interesting is that at the end, it talks about how love never fails. Nothing can defeat love. But there might be prophecies. Those are good things, but eventually they'll stop. There might be tongues and words of wisdom, and eventually they'll stop. There might be knowledge, it'll pass away. But love remains. Eventually, at the end of this beautiful poem, the greatest of these is love. At the beginning of this sentence, love never fails. So there's three things that I think are fascinating about this passage that might encourage us as we go. Number one, that love is more powerful than anything, and that was it was love that brought Jesus to the cross, and it was love that Jesus expressed in the resurrection. The second thing is that we don't get the whole story, and that's okay. That can curb our cynicism, right? The word there is, for now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. That word reflection is the same word for darkness. It's enigma in Greek, which is the same word we get enigma from. And so the idea is that what we see right now will sometimes feel confusing. We will hear the beeping sensors, and we will look. But we have to remember that we only see in part now, and one day we will see fully. And when we believe that, when we trust in that, that the resurrection is bringing newness to everybody, that changes how we look at things. And then finally, this is what I love. When Paul talks about how he was once a child, and when he was doing that, he reasoned like a child, but he became a man and put the ways of childhood behind him. He's talking about moving more toward love. So growing up is the restored innocence of love like Jesus and of trusting Jesus. So the more mature we get, the more innocent in our love and in the way that we engage with others we become. And I want to encourage you with that, to be unafraid, to be unafraid to step into that innocence.